I'm JG Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Before we get to this edition of the show, I just want to promote Wall Street Window, a website maintained by Mike Swanson that provides valuable insights on both financial markets and geopolitics. It's been around since 2003, and its slogan is "Be in the Know," and I highly recommend it as daily reading. So go on over to wallstreetwindow.com and keep yourself informed. This edition of Parallax Views is brought to you by the $10 and above tier supporters of Parallax Views on Patreon. So, with that in mind, producers credit shoutouts to Gunner, Mark, Alexander, Catherine, Tilo, Emilia, Jeff, John, Bert, Brian, Elliot, Michael, Brace, Nick,
Meresham,
Galen, Arlen, Beau,
Christopher, Michael,
Gigadelic Media, Chance, Chase, Dan,
David H, Y Kellerman, Saadad 13,
Kathleen, David,
Ava,
Bob,
The West Bank Robbery Podcast,
Jamie,
Enoch,
Gary,
Max,
Ishtofer, James, Martin, Matthew Ho,
Brian,
Nobody, Thomas, and Dano. And now on to the show.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we're joined by returning guest Professor James M. Dorsey, longtime scholar of the Middle East and the geopolitics of that region. We discuss a number of topics, including the recent protests, the pro-Palestinian anti-war protests at universities like Columbia. We have a little back and forth about that, and I should note this was recorded right before news was breaking out about the police repression happening at Emory University. There was just a teacher that got just thrown to the ground by police at Emory. Another professor has been arrested. I'm very, very worried, as you can probably tell in this conversation, about the broad anti-protest rhetoric and where that could be leading, especially as we're coming up on the anniversary of the Kent State Massacre. In any case, James and I have a little bit of discussion about the protests. Potentially you could see it as some light debate. Before that, we talk about Iran and Israel and the very tense situation we saw throughout April involving those two countries and the United States. We'll be talking about U.S. foreign policy, just really a wide range of topics, especially the latter half of the conversation gets into some really interesting areas with regards to Zionism, anti-Zionism, the one-state solution, the two-state solution, Turkey, Qatar. It really is a potpourri of topics covered in the course of this hour-and-a-half conversation. I'm sure you'll find things to agree with and things to disagree with, but as always, Professor Dorsey provides what I would say is some really learned opinions. He has been involved with this type of analysis for many years now. So I hope you'll listen to the whole conversation and let me know what you think about it. With that being said, let's get right to it with Professor James Dorsey. Welcome back to Parallax Views, a guest that I always enjoy having on. He's become a go-to for me when it comes to talking about Israel-Palestine and just issues related to the Middle East and geopolitics there. James M. Dorsey,
Middle East scholar and the proprietor of the Turbulent World blog. How are you doing?
I'm well. Good to see you.
So, James, I wanted to have you on because you wrote this really interesting piece that is like hot off the presses from your website, Words Matter. But before we get to that, do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, what has transpired in the past month between Israel and Iran? You know, there was the embassy attack, then Iran did a strike. And, you know, I felt like we were on the verge of, you know, all out regional war for a second there.
Well, there certainly was that risk. And I think that both parties took that risk. And both parties, in some ways, miscalculated. So, with other words, the Israelis have been striking at Iranian personnel, particularly members and commanders of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps in Syria, not in Iran itself, as well as other Iranian assets and affiliated with that Hezbollah. All of those strikes were in Syria. And all of those strikes, the Iranians really didn't respond much to those strikes, at least not in actions. They did so, obviously, in words. And keep in mind that, to some degree, the Russians acquiesced in this, since they have a presence there. And often the Israelis have, to some degree, not coordinated with the Russians, but let the Russians know as a matter of deconfliction. But this latest round that was extremely risky involved, first of all, an Israeli attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus. Now, again, it was hitting a senior Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps commanders who were in a annex of the consulate. Of the embassy compound in Damascus. I don't think that the Israelis thought that this was going to be a game changer. For the Iranians, I think they felt that they needed to draw a line. The consulate, in their mind, was Iranian territory, which other parts of Syria are not, and therefore they had to respond. But much like the Israelis at this point, for whatever reasons, the Iranians do not want a direct confrontation. They don't want an escalation. They certainly do not want an all-out Middle East war between Israel and Iran that would draw in other parties, including potentially the United States. And so the Iranians responded, on the one hand, with a mass barrage of drones and Scud and ballistic missiles, but they also very clearly notified everybody that they were going to do this. And these were not their most advanced drones, and these were not their most advanced missiles. So they clearly wanted to show we're capable of doing it, we're willing to do it, but we also don't want to create the kind of damage with this one strike that would force Israel to respond massively. And so what you saw in return, partly under U.S. pressure, was a Israeli response that was, in my mind, extremely measured, but also sent the message. Extremely measured in the sense that it was a few drones, but it sent the message. But it was targeted at Isfahan, an Iranian city, which is home to various military facilities, building blocks of Iran's military industrial complex, and home to a significant nuclear site. And so what they did is basically the message was twofold. One, we can hit these very vital institutions, backed up by the, and that's the second thing, backed up by the fact that they took out an S-300 Russian-made anti-air defense, anti-missile defense system. So what you had is that both parties responded, demonstrated their capabilities, but also effectively at that point said, this is it. The Iranians had said that already clearly after the barrage. They said, this is ends it. Israel responded. The Iranians, for all practical purposes, ignored the attack. There was no reporting on it. There was no condemnation. And so they both pulled back from the brink.
You mentioned that you think both parties miscalculated. Can you start with, where do you think Iran miscalculated on this? And was there another way for them to respond?
First of all, I think they miscalculated in the sense that they thought that the Israelis would take a barrage like that lying down and would not respond. And let's be clear, even if the Iranians did not want this whole thing to blow up in their face and took steps to try and avoid that, you fire 300 missiles and drones, you run the risk of causing serious damage. And if there had been serious damage, we would be seeing a war today. So the risk on the part of the Iranians was twofold. One, that this would cause damage. And two, that the Israelis would reply with their normal sledgehammer response.
And then I asked, do you think Iran could have, how could it have responded? Because I see a lot of people saying, well, if they didn't do anything, you know, it would be like they're letting Israel, you know, hit this compound and kill the IRGC officers. They have to respond in some way to, I guess, the word that's been thrown around is restored deterrence. What do you make of that kind of commentary? Do you think that's off base?
Well, no, I don't think it's completely off base. And I don't think that the issue, I think the Iranians had to respond. They had to respond not because IGRC, Islamic Guards, were being hit. That's been happening all along. But because it was Iranian territory. And I think the response, they had to be seen to be responding, both in terms of that part of Iranian society, and maybe even beyond that, that does support the regime, but also in terms of Iran's non-state allies and Iran's credibility and standing with them, and to some degree in response to what is called the Arab Street, Arab public opinion. You know, this established them as the state that was willing to stand up to Israel. So there was a lot of mileage, if you wish, in an Iranian, a credible Iranian response to what was perceived as an attack on Iranian territory.
In terms of Israel's response, where do you think they miscalculated? Is it more of the same with where you think Iran miscalculated? Do you think it's just that, you know, this tit for tat wrist way too much for both parties?
Well, I think that the Israelis didn't expect the Iranians to respond. I think they sort of expected that the Iranians would respond in the way they've responded to, by my estimate, 18 assassinations in Syria over the last 6 or 7 months. You know, that's where they miscalculated. Now, in terms of deterrence, I think what's happened is that the Israelis may have wanted to test the limits of deterrence with the attack on the embassy. And what the Iranians have said is basically by saying this was an attack on our territory. This wasn't just an attack on our people in a third country. That the Iranians basically said with their response, you attack us on our territory, we will respond. And in doing so, they not necessarily changed the level of deterrence, but expanded it, if you wish, or more clearly defined where the red lines are.
Two more things on this conflict that has been happening between Iran and Israel, the constant tit for tat. First, how do you think, how would you grade how the U.S. handled it? Because, you know, I think they were pretty explicit, you know, with the comments that Biden made to Netanyahu saying, take the win, you know, don't take this further. So what do you think about the Biden administration's response to all of this?
I think they basically handled it very well. At the end of the day, they contributed, or maybe even were successful, if you wish, in ensuring that this doesn't spin out of control. Now, what this tells you is goes far beyond, in my mind, the Israel-Iran issue, because it also speaks to the degree of U.S. leverage or influence on Iran. So, you know, the mantra of many people is Biden just Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, just puts up his finger to Netanyahu and does what he wants. That is on one hand true. But if you look at the last weeks, maybe couple of months, there have been a number of instances where de facto Israel has bowed to U.S. pressure. So we're seeing increased aid going into Israel. Into Gaza. That was under U.S. pressure. We're seeing, or we may see, but from what we're hearing, what probably is going to be a much more tailored Israeli offensive in Rafah, rather than a sweeping ground offensive that's going to target everything and everybody, as we've seen in other parts of Gaza. And then the Israeli response to Iran, all of those are in response to U.S. pressure. So while Netanyahu may not have changed his fundamental policies or his fundamental objectives, on a number of not unimportant issues, he has taken U.S. pressure into account.
Out of curiosity, what are the lines of communication between, I don't know if you'd know this, but what are the lines of communication that exists between the U.S. and Iran? Is a lot, because I've been told a lot of that goes through, there's a lot of back channels in Iraq. Do you think those communications probably helped divert things when it came to this latest kerfuffle?
Well, first of all, they're multiple. There's, of course, on the one hand, the fact that the Swiss represent the United States in Iran because the United States doesn't have an embassy there. So that's one channel. There are the Omanis, who play a very quiet, behind-the-role scenes. They have good relations with both parties, and they've been very instrumental in the past. Think of putting together the Iran nuclear negotiations. They're the Qataris, who play a role at times of a messenger boy. Then there are other channels, for example, channels that are not direct. There's the Hezbollah and the French, for example. So there are all these sort of back channels, which at the end of the day, and this goes back to the whole issue of Qatar and Hamas, countries that are in whatever stage of animosity with each other, or groups for that matter, and do not have official relationships, need channels of communication both on both ends of the divide. And you know, in some cases, in the case of Qatar particularly, The United States has, in at least on two occasions, asked the Qataris to, in a sense, upgrade their relationship with a non-state actor. Whether Hamas is one example, the Taliban are another example. Upgrade their relationships by allowing those groups to have offices in Qatar, which then facilitated communication.
This also brings to mind, you mentioned that there is this widespread perception that the Biden administration just always bends the knee for Israel. And I think there's truth to that. There's also this parallel narrative that I see, especially amongst right-wing commentators here in the U.S., that, you know, Biden is constantly appeasing Iran. And I don't see that really. But I was wondering if you could comment on that, because it is a parallel narrative that exists here, and I think it's off base.
Well, I think, first of all, one's got to keep a number of things in mind. There's Iran, obviously, is a country that in the United States has there's a lot of misunderstanding, but there's a lot of not surprising prejudiced opinion. Going back to the revolution, which was anti-American, it took down an icon of U.S. Influence in the region. It was the first time that an icon fell. You had the U.S. embassy occupation. You had the fiasco of Carter's rescue attempt, and just go down the line since. So Iran does not have a pool of goodwill in the United States. Now, add to that that Netanyahu, now for a few decades, has basically identified, certainly until October 7, has identified Iran, not the Palestinians, as the existential threat to Israel. And that's a theme that has been picked up by supporters of Israel, particularly on the right in the United States. And it's led to both of those factors, for that matter, have led to a very hardline policy towards Iran. The policy.
Right. And we can even see this with, you know, going back to Obama and the JCPOA.
Absolutely. And the policies failed. Obama saw the risk of the nuclear issue escalating into a situation of war in which the United States, Israel, either together or independent or only one of the two, would try and take out the Iranian nuclear program, much in the way that they did in 1981 with OSIRAQ, the Iraqi nuclear program. In Iraq, that was quite easy. You hit one facility and that was it. In Iran, it's not that easy. And the question is even if it would succeed. So the Iran nuclear agreement was really designed to, at least for a period of time, curb the risk of Iran becoming a military nuclear power. And the risk of that leading to war. It's failed. Sure, there's no question about it. Sanctions have hurt Iran significantly, but not to the degree that they're not able to sell their oil, not to the degree that they are not able to varying degrees, but nonetheless, to develop their military capabilities. At least, and one reason why you see that Iran's defense strategy is basically based on three things: non-state allies in Arab countries, a ballistic missile program, and a small boat navy. Nothing major. Iran doesn't have an air force to speak of. one of the military facilities in Isfahan that was in the vicinity of the Israeli response attack was a military airfield where there are aging F-14s. I mean, I recall in 1979 being on a plane with Brzezinski when he was a national security advisor.
Oh, really?
And we were flying down the Gulf from Pakistan to Saudi Arabia, and we were in international airspace parallel to the Iranian coast, and we were intercepted or accompanied, if you wish, by Iranian F-14s. And Brzezinski looked out one window to the left, he looked out another window to the right and said, gee, those are more F-14s in the air than I thought they had. So those F-14s today aren't worth very much. And we haven't seen them engaged in any military action for a very long time. So that's what Iranian defense strategy is based on. At the same time, Iran today is, for all practical matters, a nuclear threshold state. So that hardline policy has basically failed. And the only then hardline alternative is nuke them.
When you say hardline policy, are you referring to the Obama era policy, or are you referring to like the Trump policies on Iran?
Well, look, I think that hardliners when it comes to Iran are not necessarily Trumpists.
John Bolton being one example, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Bolton's always been a hardliner.
Right.
But I think you would find some hardliners with regard to Iran among Democrats. Those that feel there is no conversation possible with this regime, and the only thing that is going to work is force. You know, but that takes us into another whole other realm, that Iran is led by a supreme leader who's in his 80s, who's reportedly not in good health, and at some point in the not that distant future is likely going to be succeeded. And those that succeed him may very well be more pragmatic.
Before moving into your other article, Words Matter, you know, the one thing that strikes me, and maybe this is a good segue into the Words Matter piece that you wrote, what strikes me about the latest tensions between Iran and Israel is that, you know, there were reports that the one, you know, critical injury that happened, the lone serious casualty, as it's been called, was a 7-year-old girl. I believe she was, I know she's a Bedouin. I don't know if she was in the Negev Desert, but my understanding is she's in one of those unincorporated villages that isn't very well protected by Israel. You know, they're not allowed to build bomb shelters and whatnot. And I think it's an important case because it's illustrative of how a lot of innocent people are caught in the middle of Iran on one end and then Israel on the other. You know, these Bedouins don't really have anyone to help them out.
Let's put it this way. A lot of innocent people are caught across the board. Indeed, the major casualty in the Iranian strike was a 7-year-old Bedouin girl. And clearly she didn't have access to a bomb shelter or couldn't make it to a bomb shelter in good time. But nonetheless, she had nothing to do with whatever differences there are between Iran and Israel. But that's also true for Palestinians in Gaza. It's true for Palestinians on the West Bank. You know, and it's true for Israelis, whether those were the victims of the Hamas October 7 attack or those who, like the Lebanese on the other side of the border, have had to flee their homes because of the hostilities. You know, so in other words, a lot of people on all sides of the divide are innocent victims of this.
And that's not, we didn't even touch on, you know, the West Bank. You know, there's Gaza, then there's all this craziness in the West Bank now with the settler violence. How important do you think it is that people keep an eye on what's happening in the West Bank?
I think it's very significant. You know, apparently, anecdotally, I find the story funny. One of the latest people, settlers, to be sanctioned by the United States was a senior advisor to Israel's national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who's one of the ultra-nationalists in the Netanyahu government. And reportedly, he went the other day to a gas station to fill up his car. And when he presented his credit card, he was refused. And the reason he was refused was that Israeli banks have to follow U.S. sanctions policy, and therefore his credit card had been blocked. On a more serious note, I think what's happening on the West Bank is serious. What you're seeing is a burgeoning armed resistance, that the Israelis are, with a sledgehammer approach, trying to repress, and clearly haven't been able to do so. And then on top of that, you're seeing settler vigilante violence, which the Israeli government has done little to counter. And in fact, in some instances, is abetted by the Israeli military, which raises a whole different problem related also now to the potential sanctioning of an Israeli military unit for the first time by the United States, which is the fact that you have not a majority, but a significant number of West Bank settlers who, like everybody else in Israel, serve in the Israeli military, either in because they've been conscripted into it, or because they're reserves that are being called up, or because they're career professional military personnel. But nonetheless, they bring those attitudes into the Israeli military. And that's been something that we've been seeing for a number of years. Just go back to the 2014, the 2021 Gaza wars.
In regards to your piece, Words Matter, this just came out, I think, a few hours
ago.
A few hours
ago, that's correct.
So you're talking here about the Israeli-Palestinian battle of narratives, and you take a lot of people to task, from, you know, politicians.
I take everybody to task.
Right. Well, let's get into that. What spurred you to write this? And maybe you can talk a little bit about the basic gist of what you were trying to get at here.
Well, what spurred me to write it was two things. One was the Israeli policy, or the guidelines, if not formal, certainly in terms of on the ground in Gaza, which explains one reason why we have such high casualties. And then an interview, and I've heard this privately from others, but an interview that was public, that ran on Britain's Channel 4 with an unidentified Israeli soldier who described in great detail what he saw happening when he was serving in Gaza. And the second thing that motivated me to write the story was the whole debate about the protests in the United States on U.S. university campuses. And the point I was trying to make is is several fold. One is that, you know, I'm a absolutist when it comes to freedom of speech. I'd rather have hate speech, whatever it is, out in the open rather than, you know, simmering below the surface. And I think it's a very slippery road if you start curtailing speech. Now, having said that, that doesn't mean that you have no responsibility for what you say and should not be held accountable for what you say, whether that not necessarily in terms of legal procedures, but in terms of the debate and social pressures and procedures. And so if you take the students in the US, but also elsewhere, and by and large, pro-Palestinian protesters in large, I have no problem with whatever criticism they have of Zionism, whatever criticism they have of Israel. I may agree or disagree. That's their right. But when you do get those expressions of anti-Semitism or incitement to violence that goes beyond what is internationally legally accepted as a right to armed resistance, then those student organizers have a responsibility to distance themselves from that.
To be fair, I do think there was an activist group that did that at Columbia.
Well, unless I'm, I looked at what they said. And I looked at their Twitter feed. And in the last week, I could only find one. Well, they had issued several statements. The bulk of those statements, as far as I could see, were referred to their discussion with the university authorities on the modalities of their protest, you know, whether keeping non-Columbia people off the campus and so on and so forth. But there was one statement which clearly, on the one hand, said that they were against any expressions of racism, prejudice, what have you. But at the same time, you had a group at one of the protests at Columbia, which, to be fair, was not the mass of the protesters. It was a smaller group. It seemed to be boxed in and sort of fenced off, but who were calling for Tel Aviv to burn to the ground. And there was no mention of that in the statement. And in my mind, there should have been. You know, they were calling for support for Hamas, and, you know, people can take me to task on that. That's not something that I, by definition, would criticize. They called for the killing of another soldier. I'm not an international lawyer, but that may or may not fall within international legally defined definitions of armed resistance. But burning Tel Aviv to the ground certainly does not. And that, I think, is something they need to distance themselves from. I mean,
yeah, I was kind of perturbed by, I mean, I've seen the videos of, you know, I'm not saying this represents the whole of the protesters. We can talk about that. But I even saw the videos of people yelling, "Go back to Poland." You know, I don't think this type of thing is very helpful. And I do think that protesters need to call that type of thing out.
Let's keep in mind that the "Go back to Poland" slogan is not even Hamas is saying that. I mean, they're you know, at the most extreme, of their views. They want a Palestinian state, but they're not calling for the expulsion of the Jews anymore. They did in the past, but they're certainly not doing that now. So, but I think in that sense, the point I was trying to make is twofold. One is the consequences to what you say, whether that is the Israeli president saying there are no innocent in Gaza and saying that early on in the war, or religious figures saying that killing women and children is killing the next generation of either those that bring the next generation of what they would then call terrorists.
This is Rabbi Mali that you're talking about, right?
Right. But you go back to this interview on Channel 4. That was exactly the mood of the soldiers with whom the guy being interviewed was together in Gaza with. And in fact, he didn't quote the rabbi himself, but he quoted exactly that. You know, in his environment in Gaza, the notion was we're fighting the guys we didn't kill in 2014. So with other words, words have consequences. By the same token, when Hamas uses its blood-curdling statements, you know, there's going to be a second, a third, a fourth October 7, i.e. a attack that massively attacks civilians. That's what people in Israel are going to hear. And I took the Gutteries on a similar issue to task. And I think it's true for the students. Now, it's in my mind also true for pro-Israeli protesters. There are consequences to what you say.
So one thing in that regard, I guess what worries me about, at least here in the U.S., the discussion of the protests right now is I'm very skeptical of what I would call broad anti-activist or anti-protest rhetoric. And I think you are too, from what I'm gathering. The thing I've tried to say to people is these sort of decentralized protests, I don't know if there's a way that you can, you know, necessarily make sure that there isn't going to be bad apples that, you know, try to come in and say really crazy and heinous things. I don't know if that is the same when you're talking about politicians in Israel that are, you know, making, you know, really grotesque statements. I do think there is a difference there.
Well, yes and no. Obviously, what politicians say has greater impact, maybe, or and certainly more immediate impact. And sure, protests are decentralized, they're spontaneous, but that doesn't mean that at the level of Columbia University or the University in Austin, Texas, or the University of South Carolina, the organizing group, that doesn't alleviate the responsibility of the organizing group, whether that's a centrally national institution or entity, or it's a decentralized from university, from campus to campus. The responsibility is still there. So you, as a student organizer in Columbia, may not have influence on what happens at New York University or at Yale or whatever else, but you do have influence what happens at Columbia. And, you know, that responsibility is, I think, something you should be held accountable to. And let's face it, it's, if indeed, you know, the divisions that those groups want to draw, it's in their interest to draw them.
I agree with you on that. I think it is important that, you know, I mean, my stance on this was you know, if you see anti-Semitism as at a protest, you should call it out. I mean, for the good of the protests and the good of the, you know, whatever
and
movement you're supporting.
Let's face it, in terms of, which leads us to, by the way, one other aspect of the piece that I wrote. Taking on that responsibility and accountability, I think, is key to maintaining freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. You know, and that, in some ways, I mean, one of the things that I argued in the piece that you saw was that the Israelis have played a very questionable role in this. Because this goes, you know, for a significant period of time, even before the Gaza war, in which they have tried to limit the parameters of debate about the state itself, about its policies, and about Zionism as a nationalist ideology. And they've done so by trying to conflate any criticism, be it of the state, be it of the state's policies, or of Zionism, as anti-Semitism. And you've seen laws against, you know, and I'm not necessarily an advocate of a boycott, but nonetheless, what oranges you buy in a supermarket is your business. And yet, you've seen a fair number of U.S. states and also in Europe outlawing boycott calls for boycotts against Israel, which is, to me, irrespective of what one thinks about whether there should be boycotts, an issue of freedom of choice and freedom of expression. And in that sense, I think Israel's, you know, played a very damaging role. But at the same time, this comes back to what we were talking about before. The lines are at times blurred between what is legitimate criticism of Israel policies, Zionism, and what constitutes anti-Semitism, anti-Jewish prejudice. And that makes it even more incumbent on the critics of Israel, whether they are students or others, to ensure that they draw those lines very clearly.
Do you think as well, so a lot has been made about the lack of distinction between criticism of Israel, what constitutes legitimate criticism of Israel, and, you know, just anti-Semitism. But I even think there's a lack of distinction when it comes to criticism of Israel and Zionism or anti-Zionism. What I mean by that is, you know, there's a Columbia University professor, Rashid Halidi, who I often see referred to as an anti-Zionist, but he...
Which he is.
Well, I mean...
No, I mean, I'm not saying anything negative about
him. No, but he doesn't believe Israeli national identity is going away. You know, I think he's a two-state solution type person. Wouldn't that make him...
Yeah, but you can be an anti-Zionist and favor the two-state solution. I mean, look, whether or not...
That's what I wanted you to explain. Do you think criticism of Israel and criticism of Zionism are the same thing? I wanted to get into that.
Okay, first of all, I think that, you know, Israel, from the pre-state days, the Zionist movement, has projected the Jewish state as the safe haven for Jews. In my mind, that notion is a failure of Zionism. And what I mean by that is Israel's become the 13th tribe. And its interests, its national interests, as conceived by whatever government is in power, may or may not coincide with the interests of Jews in the diaspora. And I think one of the things that you're seeing now is, to a degree, a decoupling of what constitutes Israel's interests and what constitutes, in the perception at least of significant segments, whether a majority or not, neither here nor there right now, but a significant segment of the Jewish diaspora that no longer feel that Israel necessarily is the center of their Jewish life. And that's been, look, that's been a process that's been going on for a long time. I mean, it's at least a decade ago, maybe more, that an author, Bruce Wasserstein, if I remember correctly, wrote a book in which he essentially argued that Jews as a community were fading. And one of the things that I remember that he cited was intermarriage rates in the United States, in which you saw an increasing number of Jews and non-Jews marrying, and therefore that Jewish community, in a sense, being watered down. As far as I'm concerned, you can't maintain, it's a natural and organic process. The group flourishes, the group diminishes, whatever it may be. That's, to me, almost a natural evolution. So you've had for a long time this division of interests, which now has been far really sharpened by the Gaza conflict, which again, I think, in terms of that wedge between Israel and Jewish communities, makes, again, coming back to words matter, clearly drawing those sharp borderlines between what is legitimate criticism and what is not, all the more important.
So I want to go back to something, because we're getting into the words matter element more deeply now, because so you said that you could be an anti-Zionist and still believe in a two-state. And yet I've had other people tell me, well, if you believe in a two-state, technically you're supporting the existence of, an Israeli state. So wouldn't that make you a de facto Zionist is what others would argue, yes, but
you can spin this whichever way you want. But fact of the matter is, okay, let's be clear. The Zionist argument is that Jews have a right to the land. The more militant part of that argument is Jews have the right to all of the land. And the more moderate part of that argument is we have the right to be here. We are here. But we recognize that there are others who have claims to this land too. And therefore, we have to find an accommodation. Those are the kind of arguments that you would see on the Jewish side. And both of those would fit within the Zionist framework. The Palestinian side of the argument is simply a realist argument. Israel's a fact. It's been there for 75 years or whatever. It's not going to be replaced. And Palestinians will not defeat it militarily. And probably not even politically, even though, things have changed a lot with the Gaza war. But nonetheless. And so then the argument is, well, we need to have our own Palestinian state, and we have no choice but to compromise on the land. That's a very different argument than saying, so the argument really is, and let me go back to something else. The argument really is we accept reality and therefore are willing to live side by side. That's not saying you have the right to be here. And don't forget that if you go back to the 1980s, when the 1970s, 1980s, when the PLO was going through this, you know, with Yasser Arafat going through this torturous process of coming to grips with a two-state solution rather than, you know, the secular democratic one-state solution that they were putting forward. Israel's demand at the time was the Palestinians needed to recognize the existence of the state of Israel, which is what Yasser Arafat did in 1988. And then again with the Oslo Accords in 1993. Netanyahu changed that. And he insisted from early on that it was the right to exist, not the existence simply, that the Palestinians needed to recognize. And that's something the Palestinians haven't done, nor, you know, do I. I mean, you know, you recognize the facts on the ground. That's fair enough. And so I think, you know, my guess is, I mean, I haven't asked him that, but my guess is if you asked Rashid Khalidi, what he would tell you is, I recognize the right, I recognize Israel's existence and the need to live alongside it. That doesn't mean that I recognize the right to the land or that I recognize have become a Zionist.
I see what you mean. I haven't thought of it that way. That's extremely nuanced. That's getting into nitty-gritty details. I appreciate that explanation, by the way. I've talked to Rashid before, but yeah.
Well, you've got to ask him, obviously. I can't speak for him.
Right, right. Well, I think it is the view of a number of Palestinians. Before closing out, just to come back to the protest issue, and I know this isn't really part of the article, I guess, like, I just have this irking concern that things are going to get too heavy-handed on the anti-protest side of things. Do you think that's a legitimate concern as well?
Absolutely. I mean, look at what's happening. You have peaceful protests that are being, you know, with people being arrested. You have, you know, a grilling of university presidents that's McCarthyian. Look, you know, again, I think let me be clear on something. So take the slogan from the river to the sea. Jews interpret that as a slogan that calls for the demolition of the state of Israel. On the other hand, you have Netanyahu saying, I'm going to keep control from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean. Not very dissimilar, frankly. The fact of the matter is that if Israel were to continue its settlement policy as it does, Israel and Palestine, by definition, are going to be one state. So is calling for a one-state solution, which would involve the elimination of Israel as a Jewish state, if it is to work with everybody within the borders of that state having equal rights, is that anti-Semitic? I'm not sure it is. There's a very famous scene when Ezer Weitzman, who was the commander of the Israeli Air Force, and Minister of Defense at the time of the Israeli-Egyptian peace negotiations, and who within the Begin government, Menachem Begin's government at the time, which was a right-wing government, became a moderate after his son was killed as a fighter pilot. And if I recall correctly, during at the time of those negotiations, he was in Gaza, and he was giving a news conference, and behind him was a picture of Israel-Palestine as envisioned by the Likud party, which was from the river to the sea. And someone asked him about that map behind him, and his answer was, Arafat can dream, I can dream. So, you know, at times, you know, so Israel obviously depicts the argument for a one-state solution, which I'm not sure would work. That's not to say that I'm sure a two-state solution would work. But in any case, Israel defines that as anti-Semitism because it denies the right of the state to exist. And the fact of the matter is the state exists, you know, like it or not.
Before you get going, if you just have a few more minutes here.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you, one of the things that we're hearing a lot in the U.S. discourse right now, especially from elements of the Democratic Party, is this line that, you know, this is all the problem right now is all it's a lot of it is on Bibi. You know, I'm also hearing other more outlandish, I would say, arguments that if Iran just disappeared, all of this would be good. I mean, there's all kinds of crazy art. I just saw Nancy Pelosi saying that, you know, the protests are being driven by Russia. And I don't put much stock in that.
She said earlier it was China.
Oh, well, it's not much better.
First of all,
I wanted to ask you specifically about the anti-BB sentiment. But if you want to comment on the other stuff I mentioned first.
Well, I was going to say, just as a matter of principle, again, this is part of sort of a preformed opinion about Iran, that its relationships with non-state actors, whether that's Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Gaza, the various Iraqi groups, the Houthis in Yemen, that's a Simon Says relationship. I tell you what to do, you march.
Right.
It's not. That's not to say that the Iranians don't have influence, and that's not to say that there's potentially, on some issues, close coordination, and there's significant Iranian support. But that doesn't mean that they're simply Iranian pawns. That's one thing. Coming to your specific question, Netanyahu obviously has been a dominant figure in Israeli politics for a very long time. But whoever's going to be his successor is not likely to adopt fundamentally different policies. He may not be as narcissistic as Netanyahu is. He may not, to the degree that Netanyahu does, conflate his personal interests with what the state's interests are. But in the fundamentals with regard to the Palestinian issue, or Lebanon, or Iran, that successor, whether that's Benny Gantz or Yoav Gallant or whoever, or even Yair Lapid, he may be more malleable, but fundamentally his positions are not going to be all that different.
Well, the other reason I asked about this was because I was reading Barak Ravid's reporting from Axios last week, and one of the things he reported was that, you know, Bibi essentially said, let's wait for Biden to call, whereas others like Benny Gantz were saying, we need to respond immediately to what Iran did, to the Iranian strike. And it brought to mind, I've been told over and over again by a number of people that in some ways, Bibi is actually oddly pragmatic or at least risk averse with a lot of wars. I mean, not necessarily with this Gaza war, but in general, could that change with a different prime minister? I mean,
well, look, first of all, I think Netanyahu or Bibi in a lot of ways is risk averse. Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, at the end of the day, Netanyahu is an opportunist. And opportunists are better, by definition, pragmatic. So I think that's all true. But having said that, I mean, I think, you know, what are we talking about? So within the body politic of Israel, those that would favor a fully independent Palestinian state that were fully sovereign and, for example, would have its own military, where the Israelis, Israel and Jordan have a very close security relationship. Israel and Egypt have a very close security relationship. That doesn't mean that Israel controls Jordanian security or controls Egyptian security. There are very few in the body politic of Israel who would advocate a state that were as sovereign or as independent as Jordan or Egypt are. You know, and there's also the issue of the settlements, of course. So, you know, I think when you're thinking about the post-Netanyahu period, whenever that may be, and I would not write Netanyahu off, he's a cat with nine lives, a post-Netanyahu period may not have quite the sharp edges that Israel today has with ultra-nationalists and ultra-conservatives in the government, but whether it's, you know, the expectation that it would follow a fundamentally different policy remains to be seen.
Also, just because I know I'm going to get crap from my listeners for this, but when I say BB has been risk-averse in the past, I am not, like, condoning anything that has happened with this Gaza war, but it's something that has come up a lot. I was wondering, why has BB been called risk-averse?
I think that's his, you know, it's been his track record, basically. And, you know, whether, I don't know that Gaza has fundamentally changed that. I mean, I think that, you know, let's face it. I mean, what Hamas was able to achieve on October 7 was remarkable. It achieved it brutally. And with a degree, or Gazans, because it was not just Hamas. To be fair, even though Hamas was the driving an overriding factor in that, that was quite inconceivable, before that. And what it did is, why do you have to destroy Hamas? You have to destroy Hamas not because of October 7 as such, but you have to destroy Hamas because that is the one group today who in many eyes, whether they like him or not, and Hamas is not necessarily the overall most popular movement, but nonetheless, they have stood up to the Israelis. I mean, it's very much like Hezbollah and the 2000 withdrawal, Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon. Or the myth of the role of the Al-Karama battle in 1968 in Jordan between the PLO and the Israelis that really boosted the PLO as a resistance movement. You know, that's what this is about.
I also wanted to ask you, What do you make of this developing story about mass graves?
Look,
Con
I think
Yunus. Yeah.
Sorry?
I said at Con Yunus, I believe it was at.
Well, the Al-Nasser Hospital. It doesn't look good. The Israelis are already changing their story on it. But if you look at the Israeli, what the Israelis have said, it's more about who buried them than about who killed them. I think this has severely damaged Israel. You've had a very clear call for an investigation that is credible by the United States, even if they did not call for an independent investigation. You've had a call by the European Union for an independent investigation, as well as by the United Nations. And this is something Israel's going to have to respond to. Now, does that mean that they're going to allow an independent investigation? Certainly not. But they're going to have to come up with a credible investigation. And it's going to be at this point difficult for the Biden administration to whitewash any investigation that the Israelis come up with that is not credible. And leaving aside the fact that any investigation that the Israelis do rather than an independent entity is going to be called into question by definition. So, I'd rather see what we see coming out of investigations before I point fingers. But, the allegation that these are mass graves that happened under Israeli control are obviously credible.
The last thing go on. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but we need to see an investigation.
I mean, this leads into something. I mean, you said that, an internal Israeli investigation is not going to be, accepted at face value. Do you think we're in a whole different world now than we were maybe 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago when it comes to discussion of Israel? Because I was just reading that Michael Walzer article where he goes on about human shields and says, he went so far as to say that if 10,000 Hamas fighters amongst 30,000 Palestinians have been killed, it's not a bad ratio for such a war on urban terrain. And I'm seeing people react to that saying, I don't accept this argument. And
I did a calculation in an article, I think last week. So the Palestinians say that 34,000 people were killed. The health ministry in Gaza makes no distinction between civilian deaths and military deaths or Palestinian fighters' deaths. It doesn't even really say whether Palestinian fighters are included in those 34,000. But let's assume that they are. The Israelis say that they have killed 13,000 Israeli Palestinian fighters. That still leaves you with 21,000 innocent Palestinians killed. And you come up with a 1.5 kill ratio, roughly. Now, you start adding the injured into this with more than 70,000. The maximum estimate of numbers of Hamas fighters is 40,000. So whatever number you want to distract from the 77,000 wounded to say that those were fighters, you're keeping still a huge amount of innocent Palestinians, many of them having been maimed for life. And so, you know, those arguments are I think misleading.
Well, that's what I was going to get at, though. I think we're in a whole new world where those arguments are not holding water with large segments of the population.
There's an underlying problem, and that is that Israel has lost. First of all, there are two wars being fought in Gaza. One is the war on the ground, the physical, the kinetic war, and the other is the information war. Israel has lost the information war hands down. It's lost its global standing. If anything, it's digging itself into an ever deeper hole. And I don't know that Israel understands that. Nor do I know that Israel understands the consequences of that. You know, even if the guns fall silent today, the price that Israel's going to pay is going to be very significant. You see that again on the campuses in the United States and elsewhere. You see that in the public opinion polls in terms of Israel and the war. You're going to have an International Court of Justice trial where Israel is going to stand trial on an allegation of genocide. Now, let's be clear, and I, as you probably know and have noticed, I don't use the word genocide. Because I don't know, I'm not convinced that in terms of the legal definition of genocide, which has to demonstrate intent, I don't know that Israel had that intent or has that intent. That's not to say that there have not been any number of violations of the laws of war, of international humanitarian law, that there haven't been mass killings, that there haven't been all of these elements, and that there may have been crimes against humanity. But, you know, those are serious in and of themselves. Whether they, you know, that'll be for the court to judge whether that amounts to genocide in the legal sense of the word.
Right.
You know,
yeah. Yeah, so, I think people don't realize at times how hard it is to prove the intent issue legally. Yeah.
Absolutely. But as far as I'm concerned, crimes against humanity, mass murder, whatever it may be, are serious enough in and of themselves. And that's going to be very difficult for Israel to live down. And in that sense, I think, yes, Israel certainly, and the international community as such, have entered a new phase in which, you know, Israel's narrative and the legitimacy of its arguments has lost significant ground. And what it will take to repair that is going to involve fundamental change in Israel, which is not going to happen overnight.
What would that fundamental change be?
It would have to be a resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian problem, in which, look, what is demanded of the Palestinians, which is recognize the state of Israel, renounce the armed struggle, is what Israel will have to do, which doesn't mean renounce the right to defend, but not with, you know, but it does mean you recognize Palestinian national rights, you enable a sovereign, independent Palestinian state alongside the state of Israel, and you define the right of defense within the norms of international law.
So closing out here, I know you're not in the business of soothsaying, but it sounds like there's a pretty The picture itself is very grim right now, and I know you're not someone that's going to bullshit me. You know, there's a lot of people that I think are bullshitters when it comes to these topics. You're not one of them.
Thank you.
How bad do you think things could get going forward? Because I feel like it's grim now, but it could get much grimmer.
How bad they could get in terms of what? I mean,
in terms of Israel, escalation, in terms of what is happening to Gazans, what is happening in the West Bank, and what, I mean, ultimately the fate of Israel itself.
Look, I think, there are a number of issues here. It could get bad for it could get worse for the Gazans. I think on the positive side, you have the greater influx of humanitarian aid. The Israelis essentially admitting that their campaign against UNRWA has failed. And the logical consequence from that is that Israel should re-engage with UNRWA. You had the Germans now saying that they are going to reinstitute their funding of UNRWA. The last two holdouts really are the UK and the United States on the issue. I think a lot is going to depend on the Rafah offensive. In two ways. One is the way it is conducted and the degree to which innocent Palestinians are shielded or not shielded. And second of all, in terms of what it produces. Because let's face it, the major reason why Israel wants that Rafah offensive, and why the Americans are not fundamentally opposed to operations in Rafah, but are very clear on how they think those operations should be conducted, is not only the four battalions that Netanyahu speaks about, Hamas battalions, but also the fact that the Israelis believe that the top leadership of Hamas is in the tunnels under Rafah, and that a significant number, if not all, of the remaining hostages held by Hamas and others in Gaza are in Rafah. So the outcome of that offensive, in terms of liberating hostages, which is, I think, one reason why the Israelis are stalling on the negotiations, and their ability to take out the top leadership of Hamas, Yahya Sinwar and a few others, is going to determine what Gaza is going to look like. If Israel fails in both those objectives, it's going to be a very different picture than if Israel succeeds. So that's one element of this. A second element is Lebanon, where the Israelis have consistently spoken about striking massively against Hezbollah. Again, Gaza may be very decisive in that. Privately, Hezbollah has not ruled out pulling its forces back to 30 kilometers to the north of the Litani River, which is what the Israelis want, that they haven't ruled out that being something that can be discussed if and when the Gaza war ends, not before that. So, you know, that may be the wedge that those who try to prevent an escalation of the war in Lebanon or the war along the Israeli-Lebanese border, that may be the wedge that to try and prevent that. The Iranians have made very clear they don't want a war with Iran, with Israel. We've already seen a degree of de-escalation there. Now, having said all of this, it takes one mistake. You know, this is the region as such, but particularly those three areas more than anything else, are powder cakes. And let me just add one more thing, if I may, on Gaza, which is that, you know, Israel had three goals in the war: destroy Hamas, free the hostages, ensure that Gaza no longer can be a venue for armed resistance. Fact of the matter is that look at the north of Gaza. Hamas pops up and engages the Israelis in battles. They may not be killing all that many Israeli soldiers, but nonetheless, I wrote a story that was titled last week, I think it was something like Israel and Hamas play whack-a-mole. And there's an element of that too. So, you know, the war ending doesn't necessarily mean that the violence as such ends. It will not be as horrendous as it has been for innocent Palestinians. But it doesn't mean that all of a sudden everything's quiet.
In terms of the broader region, do you think there's a possibility that this war is going to eventually alter relations between numerous countries and entities? So what I'm getting at is I've are there red lines for like Egypt and Jordan in this? Is the relationship between Hamas and Qatar changing? Is Hamas, I keep hearing Hamas is going to become closer to Turkey potentially. What are the ramifications for all of this?
Well, okay, I think there's separate issues here. One is what I don't, you know, a lot of people talk about it's all fundamentally changed. I don't think it has. So, with other words, but there are things that have changed. So, one, the bar for an Arab state today, particularly Saudi Arabia, but for an Arab state in general, to establish relationships with Israel, diplomatic relations with Israel, to tighten existing relationships, has become far, far higher when it comes to the Palestinian issue. The Palestinian element in any agreement, Arab-Israeli agreement, will not be able to be just simply a fig leaf. Arab states, given what Arab public opinion is, need to take their publics in account. And the Palestinian issue is an important issue to their publics. That's one. Two, the notion that Israel's invincibility has been destroyed by this war, I think, is a Fata Morgana. If anything, I think many Arabs, governments, as well as publics, may have been taken aback by the brutality of the Israeli military operations. But that's a double-edged sword in some ways, certainly from a government's perspective, from an Arab government's perspective, as they look at Iran, that could be an advantage. And coming back to the very early part of this conversation, the Israeli last strike at Iran clearly showed capability and willingness. And therefore, that doesn't undermine the invincibility. And neither did, by the way, the barrage, the Iranian barrage of missiles. So in that sense, I don't think that anything fundamental has changed. The notion of Iran as a threat, if anything, has been enhanced by the last 7 months. I mean, what Hamas did on October 7 is something that the Houthis could do on the Saudi Yemeni border, or the Yemeni Saudi border. the notion of those non-state allies being threats. In fact, you had an article, I think, yesterday in Asharq al-Awsat, a prominent Saudi paper, by a prominent Saudi commentator saying exactly that. The non-state allies are a threat to our security. But operationalizing that, if you wish, that's going to take a serious stab at resolving the Israeli-Palestinian issue. With regard to Qatar and Hamas, first of all, let's keep in mind Hamas is there because the United States wanted them there and Israel acquiesced. If you go back to, I think it's the 16th of October, but I don't hold me to the date, which was the first visit to Qatar by the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, it was announced that Qatar and the United States would reevaluate Hamas's position in Doha once the war is over. So that was on the table from the beginning. What I think changed, and we saw in the last week, 2 weeks maybe, was that the, you know, basically Netanyahu played a double game for years. On the one hand, he needed Qatar because he wanted the funding for government salaries in Gaza. He wanted to keep the Palestinian policy divided between Hamas and the Palestine Authority in al-Fatah. And he wanted some degree of Qatari-funded reconstruction. Yet at the same time, he was waging a covert COVID information war, if you wish, against Qatar, accusing it of funding terrorists, of anti-Semitism, whatever it may be. What changed is when members of the U.S. Congress started taking Qatar to task on those grounds, Israeli arguments, and suddenly its relationship with the United States was being called into question. And so what you saw was a statement from the Qatari embassy in Washington. Then you saw the prime minister essentially saying abuse of the process. And you saw a second statement from the embassy and then the foreign ministry spokesman speaking out along those lines and pointing the fingers at Israel. And I think that there were two elements here. One is it's very highly unusual, unless you really have good grounds to question the integrity of the mediator, which no one but Israel did, not the Americans, not the Egyptians, not Hamas. It was only Netanyahu repeatedly said, the Qataris have influence and they're not leveraging them. And, you know, and so basically, that's very unusual for, and Netanyahu was doing that for political reasons, not because, as far as I'm concerned, Qatar had mishandled its mediation role. And I think that the Qataris, to be seen to be even-handed, then started flow, and the Israelis, for that matter, as an element of pressure, started raising the issue of Hamas's continued presence in Doha. The problem with it is that Hamas's options where to go aren't that many. Its foremost option really is Iran. But then you have a player in the negotiations with whom you have no relationship and no influence on. Turkey, we'll have to see whether Turkey wants the risk of being exposed to all the kinds of criticisms it would get if it were willing to allow Hamas to return to Turkey.
I think, too, with Turkey, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this. I think, especially under Erdogan, there's a lot of anti-Israel talk, but it's not necessarily action. You know,
That's true. But, I don't know that the Turks want to complicate their lives by having Hamas operate out of Turkey. And even if they did allow Hamas to return, they don't have the kind of leverage that Hamas has, or that Qatar has. I mean, in terms their diplomatic outreach, their role as mediators, and so on and so forth. That leaves you with Lebanon, hardly the player you want in as a mediator in negotiations, or Algeria, which is sort of off the map a bit. So I think what you're seeing is, at this point, unless you get a total breakdown, I don't see Hamas at this point moving anywhere.
Well, hey, James, I kept you along. We always have these lengthy conversations. Thank you so much. How can my listeners keep up with your work?
Well, the best thing to do is to subscribe to my Substack column, which is www.jamesmdorsey.substack.com. You can subscribe for free. If I may, I'd love to nudge you to become a paid subscriber, which helps me pay for the cost of producing the column and podcast 2 to 3 times a week, something I've been doing for the past 13 years, I think. So please consider becoming a paid subscriber, but you're more than welcome whether it's paid or not.
Thank you again, James Dorsey.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Professor James Dorsey. Go check out his work at the Turbulent World Substack blog. As always, if you appreciate the work here I do at Parallax Views, please consider supporting me on patreon.com/parallaxviews. One more time, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. It is you, the listener, who makes this show possible, so I could really use a donation. We're coming up on the first of the month soon, so please consider supporting me in May if you can. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.